been wanting to cut my head off for a retaliation for stuff that I'd done in Afghan. So we got put in hiding. We were in hiding for 3 years. As a sniper, your primary role is to gather lifetime information of the battlefield. Your second primary role is to take that target out if needed. I fired my first shot. I missed, fired my second shot, hit one guy because he stood up, and I fired my third shot. The bullet took 6 seconds time of flight to get there. The objective was done. I got his head down.
Craig, so you've got the world record for the two longest confirmed sniper kills in combat.
2,776 yards.
76 yards, all right.
We've got death threats. One, the shot that I'd done, because it all got leaked to the media. My name, my wife's name, my daughter's name, everything. My wife always imagined a red dot. I think of suicide. I think of suicide every day.
Every day?
Every fucking day.
When do you first become aware of something like PTSD then?
My wife noticed it a couple of weeks later. I got called in. They said, you're done. I said, what do you mean? He said, you're done. He said, we've got the report back. You've got...
What does nearly 3,000 yards look like? You mentioned to me earlier, like a football pitch is 112 to 115 yards.
When you do your sniping, you break things down, like, because you know roughly what a football pitch is, and you break it down.
Right.
But, yeah, it is a long way, you know, and my rifle wasn't designed to go that far.
Really?
Yeah, my rifle was designed to go 1,500 yards. With the scope capability and the ammunition and the capability of that rifle. But everyone think a bullet goes in a straight line, doesn't it? Arches.
Yeah.
And then goes down and gravity takes.
Okay.
It does. Mm. You know, that's why the big 50 calibers, the 408s, you know, rifles, they go a longer distance because it's a heavier rifle, heavier round.
Yeah.
So it's going to go longer. Yeah, but yeah, it's a long way. Like I said to you before, you know, if you go to Windsor and go by the road on the long, there's a long road there from Windsor Castle. That's a mile and a half. So if anyone listening goes there, you know, just stand on the main road bit and look up to the statue up there. That's a mile and a half. You can see how big the figures are and stuff like that.
And what was the terrain like that you were out in at that time?
Very undulating ground. But I was lucky that when I did my shot, everyone thinks I was laid down or stood up when I did my shot.
Yeah, okay.
Leant against the wall because the undulating ground, I wasn't able to make that shot in the first place. And the idea was that I wasn't going to take that shot. I just wanted to get the guy originally that I was shooting at, his head down.
Okay.
And it took me 9 shots to get there in the morning. I think called bracketing. So I fired one shot, saw it, fell, and then I lifted my rifle a bit more, fired again, till I finally hit the compound wall. And because it makes a really thud.
Yeah.
Because their walls are made of mud, shit, and God knows what. A cloud of dust. And then, the objective was done. I got his head down. I never saw him again. And then later on, that, a couple of hours later, and these two guys appeared with a machine gun. So I knew roughly why I was aiming.
Yeah.
But the idea, again, was to get their heads down to stop them firing. But I fired my first shot. I missed, fired my second shot. I hit one guy because he stood up. And I fired my third shot. And the bullet took 6 seconds time of flight to get there. You got to think fast on your feet. And that 6 seconds is a long time, you know. Couple of seconds is a long time.
Yeah.
So what I'd done, I fired my third shot, and as I fired my third shot, I counted to 3 in my head, and as I counted to 3, I moved my rifle across, and I fired my fourth shot. So I had 2 bullets in the air at the same time, but 3 seconds apart.
Right.
Third one missed, fourth one hitting.
Right, yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because you might say 6 seconds, and people are like, oh, that goes out there, snap your finger, but I know, like, with audio, for people who are listening to this, if you stop, and neither of us says anything.
Yeah, it's a long time. As a sniper, you've got to keep composure, really, when things are going headless around you. You've got to stay, because you've got to calm your breathing down, you've got to calm your heart rate down.
I was going to ask you about that. When you see like the guys doing a biathlon and they're skiing and then they have to stop, their rifle out.
Total composure, their breathing, everything, you know.
Yeah.
Because when you hold that rifle quite close and your heart's going, you know, your crosshairs will flick inside. You can feel your heartbeat inside. So you just need to be total, you know. I shoot with both eyes open. So I've got one eye on the target, one eye going somewhere else. You know, I'm always got peripheral vision around because it's a 360 battle at the end of the day.
Yeah, and I early, and a friend's birthday for the first time, I always wanted to do it. No idea why, I'd never done it before, but when, like, shooting clays, and it was that thing of having to shut one eye, like the old boy giving me some advice, and he was all over the place, like, shut that eye, and then all of a sudden you're, like, hitting stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Right, okay, how does that work?
No. I could... Snipery, and I could teach you to shoot a rifle in the morning and you'd be shooting long range, not a problem. It's the sniper bit, which is the difficult bit, being the sneaky bastard. That's the hard bit.
Yeah.
You know, shooting is a knack and it's a perishable art as well. So you got to keep on at it all the time, you know, to keep your end in, as they say.
What made you decide to become a sniper?
I joined the army basically to become a farrier. That's what I joined the army for. And that's why I joined the House of Cavalry.
Right.
Been riding horses since I was little. You know, I wasn't a privileged sort of kid, me and my brother. But my mum sort of like got me a horse. So I had a horse and just a little plodder it was. And I was just to look after him. I loved him to bits. You know, then I started show jumping, doing cross country and stuff like that. I got another horse.
Yeah.
You know, so I was very, very grateful for my mum to have a good upbringing.
Yeah.
And we moved around a lot, but we finally settled down we could have horses.
Where were you?
In Cheltenham.
Okay.
Yeah, nice place. It's just full of old people. There's no job prospects down there.
No.
I remember my granddad, who I looked up as a farmer figure because we were a single parent family, you know, and my granddad always said to me, get a trade. Mm-hmm. And my mum was in the RAF, she was a dog handler. My dad was a dog handler in the army. You know, I don't really know him now. He left when I was really little. And my granddad was in the RAF, you know, and I joined the army. My brother joined first, he joined the army first.
Okay.
He joined the King's Troop Royal Horse Artillery. And but it's funny, he had no interest in horses at all. And I wish he fucking did, because he could have given me a hand with the horses in the morning.
Indeed.
You know, it just me. Yeah. You know, it was a lick out, just getting up in the morning, going to school, doing the horses, coming back, doing the horses.
Yeah.
My brother joined the King's Troop. So he's a year older than me. And I thought, well, I'm going to join, you know, so I joined the House of Cavalry and I thought I want to be a farrier, you know. And I always say to everyone that I talk to, always have a plan B. I went AWOL and joined the French Royal Legion. I thought, fuck this, I can't do this. And I was bouncing guards and everything. But you must think, or people must remember that I was a single parent family. My mum, it was me, my mum, my brother, my granddad. And my granddad didn't live with us, but he was always on the scene. And I had a very sheltered childhood, because I had responsibilities like the horses.
Mm.
So I'd get up early in the morning, do the horses, go to school, come back, do the horses. So I didn't have friends to knock around with. I didn't have friends to socialise with. So when I joined the army, I'd never drunk before, never got into a fight before, never had money in my pocket. You know, one minute you're in London, fuck, you're a weekend millionaire, you know, you're just... You're going, you're doing stuff, you're drinking, you get into fights and everything. And I thought, this is not what I want. You know, I want to, because I had a blowout for a few years, got myself in so much trouble and no plan B. Yeah, so during the French Foreign Legion, which didn't last long, a couple of weeks, because I was honest with them.
Yeah.
And I said I was AWOL and they don't accept people that are AWOL anymore.
Yeah.
And they sent me back.
Day.
Yeah, and went back to England, handed myself in, did a bit of time in NIC, military NIC, and then I think I did about 15 days or something, and then carried on soldiering.
When you get into that situation, do they, when you come out of the NIC, do they lay it on the line as to this is your...
They, I was price fighting as well in London.
Yeah.
You know, because I was just going to a dark rabbit hole where I was just fighting, and I was fighting for money as well. So, and was I good at it? 50-50. You know, yeah. Some days I lose, sometimes, but the money was good.
Yeah.
You know, and I used to tip up the next day in the yard with split lips, split eyes, and, you know, broken noses, ears, four collied up and stuff like that. And they said, well, we're going to take you out of London. So they took me out of London, and my other regiment, because my regiment split to two, so you've got the ceremonial side and you've got the armoured side as well, yeah. Reconnaissance, and that's based in Windsor. So they took me to Windsor, and I flourished.
I was going to say, that's different gravy.
Fucking flourished. Absolutely yeah. Flourished. Absolutely loved it. Loved going and exercised. Loved being in the country. Mm. Loved, I just loved it, you know. And at the time, my regiment wasn't set up for snipers. So when you do a tour and you come off that tour, your sergeant major would come around to you and say, you need to do career courses. What do you want to do? And you say, I want to be a gunner. I want to be an operator. I want to do this. I want to do that. And it was always revolved around the Household Cavalry, you know. And I remember speaking to this sniper in Iraq. And I thought, this is what I want to do. I want to become a sniper. Because, one, they get treated like adults. You know, they got more responsibility on tours. You know, and they get Gucci kit and stuff like that. So I said, this is what I want to do. And I kept saying, I want to be a sniper. And I said, no, you can't do that. And I just kept on and on and on. And eventually, the guy in charge of the Armoured Corps, which my regiment was belonged to, as well as the Household Division, but the Armoured Corps itself, because we had track vehicles, finally said, yeah, we're allowed snipers into the regiment. I thought, brilliant. And I said it one day, and he goes, yeah, you're off. But the trouble is, I had no pre-course. So before you do a course in the army, you always do a pre-course.
Okay, yeah.
So you don't go there blind. Mm. I went there blind because of knowing the regiment to give me a pre-course.
Yeah.
So I just took my kit back, you know, with my uniform in it and stuff like that. I didn't have a kiddie suit, didn't have a rifle, didn't have sticks, didn't have oddballs, binoculars, laser binos, spotting scope, didn't have ammunition, didn't have fuck all. You know, I'm lucky enough, a Coldstream Guard had loads of spare kit.
Really? Is that good?
I managed to lend it all off him, sort of thing, you know, to do a course.
Yeah.
And I think 30 started my course and four passed.
That it?
Yeah. It's a high attrition rate.
Massive.
You know, yeah, massive.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot of fitness involved. Mm. And like I said, it's just shooting phase. You've got near, mid and far. You have to pass these badge tests, they call them. And if you fail one, you're off. But if you pass the badge shooting and then you go on to do your sniping phase, that's the hardest bit. Being sneaky is hard. And I'm 6'4". Walking around in a ghillie suit, I stand out.
Yeah.
So I have to make myself as small as possible, you know. And, I just flourished. And I went back to the regiment as a badge sniper, you know, the first one in the regiment.
Amazing. And do you think that was just your persistence that got you that role in the end?
I didn't have a plan B to start off with. But really, I didn't know when I said I want to be a sniper. That was my plan A again.
Yeah.
I didn't really have a plan B. So yeah. And I just kept hanging and hanging, you know, and eventually, you know, luckily enough, they called him Drac, you know, of the Armoured Corps, decided, we're allowed snipers in the regiment. You know, because we did an armour, we do reconnaissance, and being a sniper is a reconnaissance role as well, in a way. Because people always think, as a sniper, you just go out and shoot people, you know, but it's not the case. As a sniper, your primary role is to gather lifetime information of the battlefield. That is your primary role. Your second primary role is to take that target out, if needed. So being sneaky is the way forward.
Why do you think, from it sounds like your childhood, single parent family, but you must have been pretty disciplined to be able to look after the horses and that.
My mum was very Victorian, and I always used to worry what mood she'll come back in the morning. So I would worry, do you know what I mean? Because she was quite strict with us.
Yeah.
But,
My mum's like this little legend of a little Welsh lady, but I always remember this green hairbrush, like this bone hairbrush, and you'd literally back of the legs, back of the head, bish bosh, you know, yeah. My girls don't know anything about that these days.
My mum was a horse whip.
Jesus,
but a long tongue, so like a schooling whip. So she's now she'd have to
run for that.
She just had to fuck the whip, yeah. Hairbrush, spoon, stuff like that, you know. But no. It made me a better person for what I am today, discipline wise. And so did the army. They gave me discipline as well. And it made me stick out because training now in the army is a certain amount of weeks. When I did training, I was in Household Cavalry, Bloom Royal, in the Guards Depot in Purbeck when it was the Guards Depot. So I was a horse shagger, fucking horse wanker, fucking God knows what. I got picked on every day for being in the Household Cavalry because it was the guards, you know, and that's how disciplined they are. But if it wasn't for my upbringing and the way I was, I would doubt if I would have stuck to it. And because my mum made me a tough cookie, you know, and I did well. I did well.
What did she think about it?
I haven't spoke to her in about 15 years. Yeah, I miss her, you know, but... too much water under the bridge to make things up, I think.
Yeah.
One of the issues was I got blown up in Afghan and my mum never came to the hospital. And I just questioned it all the time, why'd you never come? Why'd? And my wife Tanya's mum and dad came.
Yep.
And my mum went to a dog show.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
And I questioned it. And then, you know, she said she told me to fuck off and didn't phone down on me. And I think that's the last time I spoke to her.
And why do you think, like, interested to know, Craig, to you know, to be brought up in that environment and to have that discipline and that responsibility to look after horses, why do you think you said you kind of, like, flipped out and you ended up, you know, prize fighting, ended up in military jail?
I just think because I didn't experience childhood, you know. It's like child labour. But when I was little, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, lads were knocking on school, playing football, God knows what, and... I was dealing with the horses.
Yeah.
And then summer holidays would come. I ended up putting fence posts in, creosoted fences, you know, still doing the horses. Don't get me wrong, I went to horse shows and events and all that. I was lucky enough to do that.
Yeah.
But, mum put me to work instead of enjoying the summer holiday. So I would, you know, instead of sitting around enjoying it, she put me to work. And she had loads of dogs as well, my mum. And big dog shower, big dog breeder. And then, you know, I was cleaning dogs out and creosoting on their fences and doing everything. Boom.
So it always comes out at some point, doesn't it? I think. Always we've been at college and the one guy had been brought up by a really strict Welsh family, was in the choir and all this, in literally first term in college, he just went like bananas.
Yeah.
All like kind of, you know, restricted and everything's like held in, what have you. And at some point, you're going to let that off.
Oh, massive.
Yeah.
Honestly. Mm. Yeah, especially being in London as well.
Yeah.
You know, for you like that, because you're a country boy, you just see the bright lights, you're going, fucking hell, and you get to a nightclub and you go, what the fuck's going on here? You know, and then I got to a few fights, realised I was good, you know, and this guy noticed me, and that's what I sort of got into, really.
Got it.
Regret it.
Do you?
Yeah, I wish I had concentrated on my army career more.
Yeah.
And I wish I'd have joined the Marines or something. And being directed, and instead of doing farrier, do this, get a trade, and stuff like that. I wish I was directed more in my career in the army. But it wasn't like that back then. You know, not like now when you've got, like, speakers and people guiding you. Mm. But when my time, it wasn't like that. You just get on with it and sort of, like, suck it up.
And do you still have a love of horses now?
Not mega. I love horses. Love horses and love horses. Horses is so good for mental health as well. They sense your anxiety, they sense your stress, and it's not necessarily they will come up to you. And down in Portsmouth, there's a horse therapy centre. And Lenny's got this little small horses that do not breed there. And they come up to you and nudge you. And they help Down syndrome children as well. They're very good with the same. Yeah, horses are amazing creatures. You know, such a powerful fucking animal as well, you know. But I'm knackered. I've got two false hips. You know, I'm in pain all the time. I'm on painkillers. So getting on the horse again and doing what I used to do is probably a no-no. But I'm going to have to go to a stable and clean out, muck out, groom the horse, you know, tack it up and help others. I'd love to do that. You know, maybe that's something I could do in the future probably.
Yeah, my youngest, who's just turned 15, she started about 2.5 years ago, So take her out to the New Forest now, to a place called Burley Villa at Bachelet, every Saturday, you know, and she absolutely loves it. I don't know what the next steps are. Like, we'd like taking her out to Kingston Moorwood to see, like, you can do, like, your A-levels there, but it's all, you know, focused on that. Yeah, question the equestrian, yeah. And I just thought, look, you again, life's short, do something you're passionate about, exactly, rather than just think you have to go down the traditional route and get normal A-levels and do whatever.
Do something that you're going to get bored, you're going to love, like you said, or do something you're going to get bored with so quickly. I've known people who went to college to study, then went to university to study, got their degrees, but they're not doing the job they studied with because they can't get a job or they don't like it anymore.
No. So tell me then again, how long were you in the army? You did 10 tours, am I right?
10 tours, 23 years.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, you do a thing called VEN, where you could sign on for another 5 years.
Yeah.
Because it's 22 colour service, and then you sign on for VEN, which gives you another 5 years. And that's what I signed up for because I didn't really want to leave.
Yeah.
You know, I was, the army institutionalized you in a way, you know, and everything's on a plate with you. You know, dentistry, medical, stuff like that. Bills.
All done for you.
Yeah, it's all done for you. And I didn't really want to get out, you know, because I didn't understand what Civil Street was really about, really. Mm. It scared me, Civil Street did. You know, I was petrified that I was going to get out of the army and become homeless.
Were you?
Yeah, because I think I don't know any life skills.
Yeah.
Because the army is telling you before me, you've got no life skills. You know, so these people that join the army now, and then buy a house when they're in the army.
Yeah.
That's got their head screwed on there, you know. Instead of living in camp or a married quarter, you know, not having anything behind you when you do get out. Because the army's not forever, you know, and you've got to move on. And I wish it was forever. I wish they ranked their age up like the Navy do or things like that, or the Peace Force.
Yeah.
You know, because I would have stayed until I was 100, probably.
Really?
Yeah. Combat material, even mobility school or something, you know, gilly up.
So you left basically at the time, you were done. That was it. Your time was coming to an end.
I got medical discharged with CPTC.
That's right.
And then my hip problems. I got a brain injury as well. I needed my hand operated on as well. And everything was just falling apart on me from the explosion. My last African tour was pretty fucking rough, very kinetic, and just pretty rough on all of us, really, mentally and physically. For my job was being a sniper as well. You're engaging targets, taking targets out, doing certain missions. You're not really relaxed, and there's nothing I really couldn't talk about it even to my wife, you know, because on the phones out there, they're always bugged or something, they're always getting broken into by the insurgents and certain stuff that you can't, a bit of OPSEC would, you know, you've got to screw them out a bit by yourselves.
How many times did you get injured in your career?
Yeah, I was very lucky on all my tours, so lucky. You know, in heavy firefights and stuff like that, I always managed to screw and cut some bruises. But my last tour, I had more responsibility, and that's where, you know, I hit an idea, got shot in the helmet. First of all, in a big firefight, and it went round my helmet, came out top, knocked me out for about 20 seconds.
And
knocked out cold, you know, because there's three spikes to a bullet. So they get supersonic when it comes out, and it goes transonic, and then it goes subsonic. Transonic is when it starts wobbling, and then it sorts itself out, and because it's lost so much energy sorting itself out, it goes subsonic, and then it hits the target, or depends on where you are at the time. And there's certain distances where it's got those three transfers and bullet. But an AK-47 it was, and it hit me in the side of the helmet, going supersonic from the distance that he shot at. My wagon got hit about, I think when we counted all the bullet holes, about 136 times, because you have to collateral damage, battle assessment, stuff like that.
Yeah.
So my jerry cans went with water and fuel, spare wheel, everything. I was also an open top vehicle as well.
Oh, okay.
So, and
is that where you got a brain injury from?
I got a concussion, but I got no recognition of what I'd done. And apparently, I stayed on top of the hill, extracted all the blokes off the hill, carried on fighting, and then extracted myself off the hill, and then got back to safe safe location.
But no recollection at
all? No recollection of it.
Wow.
Yes, and they said you've got amnesia, a bit of amnesia, from the round hitting your helmet, knocking you out. The only recollection I've got is a story my driver told me.
Okay.
That was it. Yeah, apart from that, I got nothing. And then I think 3 weeks after that, I hit a 30-kilo antitank mine, and then it hit the side of my right side again.
Right.
Added to my brain injury.
So, when did you, given that all, and your hips, have you had two hip replacements?
Four hip replacements.
Okay, well, two mates who aren't even 50, and they've, again, had a bad.
They only last for 15 years, so you've got to be replaced again.
Right.
So, on a big countdown.
I was going to say, you do.
Yeah, because I go to the gym and all that.
Yeah.
I try not to do too much leg work because I'm in pain. My lower back hurts, my hip hurts, my right one really hurts, you know, and it shouldn't hurt, but I've got to go back to the surgeon and say that, you know, what's the score with this?
Yeah. How old are you now?
49.
Okay. So the next one, in theory, if you had it, the next 12 months would take you up. Yeah, okay. Then you need them again.
Yeah.
It's nuts, in that I've seen my friend, said Timo, who's a windsurf, and the other one, they're both like water sports guys, and maybe that's, you know, a commonality, again, doing something like that extreme, but after he had his first one done last year, was it the year before, he was 7 weeks after the operation, he's like upside down off the top of a wave and stuff.
Yeah.
And he kind of pushed that a little bit.
Yeah, they get you walking straight away.
Right. Okay.
So as soon as you have your hip done, they give you, I went down in the morning, and they don't do both at the same time. I had one a year apart. And they wait for the morning, afternoon, they wake you up and they get you out of bed.
Wow.
You're walking out, that's fucking horrendous.
I guess they want you out, don't they, these days?
It's a sausage machine.
Yeah.
I was the youngest in the wedding.
Well, yeah.
They're all elderly people, and I just sat there going,
And when, you know, you kind of accumulate those kind of injuries, when do you first become aware of something like PTSD? You know, this kind of signs?
I didn't notice it.
Right.
My wife noticed it first.
Wife did.
Tanya noticed it, and then work noticed it. I couldn't control myself. You know, so when another squadron were playing enemy, or another regiment were playing enemy, fuck, I was cable tying them. I was just fucking treating them like you would an insurgent, you know, with dignity, but you would treat them. And I got called into the MO's office. And they said, we're going to send you off to Aldershot, to the mental health place there for more assessment. Sent me off, came back, and then a couple of weeks later, I got called in. They said, you're done. I said, what do you mean? He said, you're done. He said, we've got the report back. You've got CPTSD, few issues and stuff like that. And said, what we're going to do now is go on guard and leave. So leave now, go home, and we'll get hold of you in relevant time, which they did. It took me a year to get it.
And are you coming up with a plan B then in your mind?
Well, in fact, we were living in secure housing at the time because we got death threats from the shot that I'd done, because it all got leaked to the media. My name, my wife's name, my daughter's name, you know, my dog's name, where I lived, everything. So we got death threats off the Taliban, or not the Taliban, but like Al-Qaeda, been wanting to cut my head off.
No,
for a retaliation for the stuff that I'd done in Afghan. So we got put in hiding. We was in hiding for 3 years.
How's Tanya?
She had a breakdown.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was, because she's a social butterfly, you know, and she had a breakdown. And I felt very responsible for her, for my actions, that what I'd done on the tour. How dare I bring things home? From tour, what stays on tour, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, I brought everything back with me, and I feel for her, you know. And to this day now, I think she's got secondary PTSD. I never knew that existed. But yeah, secondary PTSD off me, what they've seen and what what I've seen sort of cascades onto her.
Oh, you know, okay.
I never knew that was a thing, but it is a thing, yeah.
And anyone can understand how you'd feel responsible for that as well. Even though, again, it's that thing, isn't it? You can't control what you can't control. You can focus in on what's under your control.
Yes.
What kind of? So you get put in secure housing. What other kind of support do you get?
The Soviet police were amazing.
Okay.
Absolutely fucked. We had armed spots call out. Tanya had an alarm that she used to wear around her neck. Our house that we lived in at the time was filmed in the windows because the bomb went off outside. It would, you know, the windows wouldn't shatter. I wouldn't say a panic room, but we had a secure place to go in the house. If anything happened, we had alarms in the house, alarms on all the doors and stuff like that. You know, I had to check my car with a mirror all the time.
Well, 3 years?
Yeah. And then they found out that there was a car in Birmingham lined out with plastic, and the inn found it, and the police found it, and for the information that they got, and I had my picture in the car ready to come and get me.
How does that make you feel now?
It's still on my mind. It's still on the back burner, on the back of my brain. Mm-hmm. You know, the what if. Because the army always teaches you the what if factor.
Yeah.
You know, always think of the what if. And yeah, always think about it. Always worry about my security, always. But if I cower and hide it, I'm not going to succeed in life.
No.
So why should I let these fuckers, you know, rule my life?
Yeah.
You know, and I'm a strong man, I'm a big man, you know, and I will fight. And I will bite your fucking ears off if I have to get out of the situation, you know. And yeah, it does worry me. Worries my wife. My old wife always imagined the red dot.
Yeah,
she was panicked and everything. But yeah, I'm out there now. Thanks to the media.
Yeah,
you know, I'm out there. She just typed my name in the computer, my life comes up.
Yeah.
So if it wasn't for that, I doubt if I would have been. I would have took a little bit of a back burner, but because it's all out there, embrace it, I suppose.
And when do you decide within that timescale, Craig, to choose a different career path then? That you write a book, you have your school, that you used to talk more about as well?
I wrote a book because my life's really interesting, apparently.
Yeah, we could see that on YouTube, can't you?
My life's really interesting.
Yeah.
But I couldn't just write about the shop because it'd be like a pamphlet. So yeah. I wrote about my life story and things that I did as a child, you know, did in the army and stuff like that. Yeah, it became a bestseller.
Yeah,
you know,
congratulations.
Never experienced that, you know, especially being dyslexic. But I was quite lucky. I did the Dragon. There's a Dragon app. You get on an iPad, you talk into it.
Yeah.
So I did majority on that and had a ghostwriter.
Yeah.
And we kept it raw. You know, we didn't fluff it up and we didn't add little bits to make it exciting. It is what it is you know, I've done it, you know.
Is that one of those things that, again, you think about going back to when you were in school and if someone had said to you, you'll write a best-selling book in a few years, decade or two, you'd have gone, what are you talking about?
Yeah, at school, I was a bit of a class clown at school, you know. And they say the school... Do you know, somebody said to me that your school days are the best times of your life, you know, and people and these younger generation fucking hate it these days. But I look back and go, yeah, I suppose it was, you know, and I was a bit of a class clown, making everyone laugh all the time. My granddad said, you've got a gift, you know, and I said, oh, clean, I've got horses. That you can make people laugh, you know. It's all changed now because of what I go through, but back then he goes, yeah, that's your gift, you can make people laugh. You light up a room, you walk into a room, people want to talk to you and stuff like that.
And when does the idea come for the school then as well, the survivor school?
So I set up a survivor school about 2.5 years ago and I wanted to help veterans. And then it turned out that there's more people out there suffering. So I want to help first-line responders, sort of the police, ambulance and fire brigade. And then I want to start, I think, fuck it, it's just not them that suffer, it's civilians that suffer as well. Mm. And people must understand that military PTSD is different than police, different than fire brigade, different than ambulance, you know. But it is PTSD at the end of the day, you know. It's not going to cross over at any point, you know, but you're going to stay parallel with each other. And same with civilian PTSD. So I set up a surviving school and it does all aspects of bushcraft. So they tip up on a Friday, and then on the Friday we just have a little knit now around the fire and the woods, and then on the Saturday we just do loads of bushcraft stuff.
Yeah.
And people love it, and it's the max I take is 6 people.
Okay, it's a small group.
Yeah, I'm thinking, because I feel if I took 15, 10, 20 people, you're not going to get the same atmosphere as it would with six people. Mm-hmm. And I don't get six people all the time, I get three people, four people, you know, and it's all private. And what's different about my school is that my therapist, Ross, he comes down on the evening, on Friday, on Saturday evening, and he sits and talks to everyone. And if you are struggling, you go for a walk with him, and he'll give you ideas, and he will follow you up. He won't abandon you.
Yeah.
He will follow up on you and to make sure you're okay. And he will point you in the right direction to get help.
That's really good USB.
Yeah.
Yeah, making it different from every other
side. Oh, massively.
Yeah.
Massively. Okay. And I've just recently been gifted some laser tag guns. And they're like proper rifles.
Yeah, okay.
So I'm going to add a bit of a sniping phase into the bushcraft school as well.
Nice.
Because that's my role.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, I've been gifted 10 of them.
Amazing.
So, and they got a distance of 300 yards.
Really?
Yeah. So
for the lasers?
Really? Yeah. So I'm going to bring a bit of a sniper phase into the school as well.
Yeah.
So people can experience what it's like to be chased, what it's like to be gillied up, what it's like to be a sneaky bastard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And is that, do you roll like just, you do weekends, like most weekends you're literally doing that?
Yeah. Like for the first 2 years, I was doing weekend. Every weekend, and I was burning myself out.
I was going to ask you.
You're burning myself out because I suffer with my mental health. I need a bit of a breather. Mm. I wanted to spend a bit of time with Tanya, you know, because we are close. So this year I've done weekend on, weekend off.
Okay.
And it's worked out much better. And I'm fully booked now, except for one or two places that I can fill all the way up to September.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah.
Well done,
and I'm doing stuff for. I've got some Belfast kids, underprivileged Belfast kids coming over. I've got some cadets coming over from Windsor and stuff like that. So, yeah, the schools get better. And I've just applied to be a charity.
Okay.
So I got turned down twice because they don't class mental health as a charity.
You're joking.
You know, so we had to label it a different way. And we've just recently just put the paperwork in again. So hopefully, touch wood, you know. We will be recognised as a charity.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Yeah, so I can start getting the school. Because I like to put a bit of a log cabin in the woods as well.
Amazing.
So when the neighbours really foul, you know, people can go to the woods with a log burner, and we can sit around and still talk, and people are warm and dry.
Yeah.
You know, because nothing like being cold, wet, and hungry. Well, me, I don't care.
But, so the average judge, And how long do they spend with you then? When do they go back?
So it's the tip-up's Friday, about 6:30 in the evening. We meet at a pub car park. I take them into the woods, and they finish Sunday about 10 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay. Yeah. We did out the other side of Dorset, but me and my mates, we did foraging. We thought it was going to be more like bushcraft. That's the kind of stuff we wanted to do. And instead, some of it was good, but... We didn't want that for like 3 days, which was like, you know, looking at nettles and mushrooms and what have you. And I like that element, but we were expecting more surviving skills, to be honest with you.
I throw so much in that I don't wear a watch. I don't wear a watch on doing the course. And I ask them, I say, well, what time is it? They said, it's 7:30 in the morning. I said, okay then. And I said, all right, I'll leave it. And then I'll ask them again, what time is it? And they go, it's 7:30 in the evening. Where's the day gone? Because I fit so much in. Wow. You know, I cook them breakfast for the 2 days. And in the evening, my wife, Tanya, will cook an evening meal for them, like a stew or meatballs and pasta or whatever.
Yeah.
So, and if you haven't got the kit, just let me know by an email. I've got 10 sleeping bags. I've got all the kit. Just bring one kit down and some nibbles.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what it's all about.
How do people... hear about you, like where do your customers come from at the moment, mate?
Word of mouth.
Yeah.
Podcasts that I do.
Yeah.
And also from my webpage, I've got a webpage, the Maverick Survivor School. And you go on there, you book on, email me, and I'll just get straight back to you.
So the Maverick Survival School.
Yeah.
.com. Amazing. And that's every other weekend that you're doing.
Yeah, so I've got this weekend off.
Yeah.
Next weekend I'm on, and the weekend after. So I'm doing a bounce next week. To the following weekend, because I had to cancel the first weekend of March because that's when I opened, reopened. So I stopped in October, reopened in March because the weather,
yeah,
stuff like that. Okay. But hopefully if I get a log cabin, I could do a year round sort of thing, you know, because it's nice and warm. And then, I'd cancel the first weekend because the weather was horrendous.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have minded it.
Yeah.
But I've got to think of my people.
Yeah. You know,
safety first at the end of the day.
Mm. And how important to you now is getting out into nature?
Nature with mental health is the natural cure.
Yeah.
I don't say a cure, but I would say a natural release.
Yeah, respite, whatever.
Yeah, for sure. Like that. Yeah. And trees, let off pheromones and stuff like that. It just makes you feel relaxed. And what's good about my school is I'm not time barred. So I'm not going, you know, I've got an hour to do this lesson in.
True.
If it goes over, it goes over.
Yeah.
You know, and if I don't do stuff, and because it gets dark, they come back the following weekend, or the weekend after,
a
month's time, and finish off. You know, it's not stress. It's there to be relaxed. It's there for you to have that respite from your mental health. And what's good about it is you can't get a phone signal there. You know, I know where you can get a phone signal for emergency services.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to tell you.
No.
I just want you to have that 12-hour respite.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you get everyone to put their phones in a box?
No, and they just can't get a signal.
No, for me, it's like huge. And I think a lot of people, you know, during that lockdown period, had that kind of reset. And for me, I discovered running. I hated it my entire life. And what I worked out is it wasn't like pounding the beach, like dodging the crowd, but it's actually when my daughter was with the horses in the New Forest, I'd take off into the forest on a trail run, and it's just me. And I would see, like, you know, deer with antlers, like, watching me in the undergrowth. And you just see ponies, cows, you know, all of that. And like, I literally come back thinking I've had like a quadruple espresso or something like that, you know, on a high. And I started, you know, going in the sea. We've now got a group, we've been doing it for 4 years this May, like going in the sea all the time. And it's just having that, you know, in some time, because how cold it bloody is in, you know, January, February. We did like 31 days in January straight for a charity and raised like 18 grand. But it's just having that kind of touch point on a daily basis with nature. Otherwise, if you're in like we are now in a, you know, four walls, no windows, etc., would go crazy, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you would, yeah.
You know, literally. What was the one thing that you think you needed to screw it, just do it, and get you from where you were to where you want it to be, to where you are now?
My wife.
Turn in.
Yeah, she's directed me. Mm-hmm. Encouraged me to write a book. Encouraged me to do the school. The second beyond that would be Ross. He encouraged me as the school, my counsellor. Yeah.
Got it. And what was if there was like a big domino that knocked all the other dominoes over, what was like the kind of first action that got you started on that path? If you hadn't have taken that action, you never would have ended up where you are now.
People's generosity and donating stuff to me because they didn't have the money. Because I fund the school in my own pocket.
Yeah.
So, and having that first something set up a GoFundMe page, I think I did James English podcast.
Yep.
And they set a GoFundMe page up and I got quite a bit of money, just enough to buy some kit. And I think this is my separate stone. This is my first domino, you know, and it's becoming a dream.
Yeah.
You know, and then nervous doing it, and it's become bigger and bigger.
What's the vision now that they've been doing this couple of years, and you've got the dream of, you know, the next kind of phase could be the log cabin? Will be the log cabin. What does the vision look like? Have you mapped it out in your mind already?
I just want the school, because I work full time in the week as well, work in a factory. I work 9 hours in the week and I don't work Fridays and then Saturdays, so that's with the school. I'd like to give up my job and just construct the school full time.
Yeah.
And put 100% effort in it. And I'm sure if I put 100% in it, which I do now, but let's say 110%, another 10% in it, it's just going to get better and bigger. You know, not as in people-wise, but as in what I can offer you and stuff like that.
How could people help get you, anyone who's like, you know, listening, how could people help you, you know, fulfill that dream of doing that full-time? Yeah.
There's a donation button on my webpage. It goes into a PayPal account. Everything that I earn from my school goes back into the school.
Yeah.
You know, I've made no profit off that school at all. It just goes back in. Because I want it to be better, I want it to be good. And I think my military discipline helps me. And I've got two guys that help me as well. Harry, fucking godsend, I've got another guy just joined me, Andy, and the real help. But Tanya does the food, preps it all. So I've got things behind the sidelines, that I have to prep before the school starts. But yeah, there's a donate button. And then people say, oh, can we give you, just go donate. You know, oh, how much can we give for this weekend? We haven't paid. Just donate. You know, a little bit or much, whatever, a little bit helps. Get some food in, get some stuff in, and that'd be much appreciated.
Or sign up and come away for a weekend.
Come down.
With a group of friends.
Yeah.
Maximum six.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You experience the school.
Question that people normally kind of pause on is a question of, are you currently where you want to be?
Yeah. As in my mental health?
Yeah, why not? Your mental health and your future vision, which we, you know, I guess we've just covered with that. That's where you want to get to with the business, is be full-time doing that with survival school. Yeah.
I struggle a lot, and I struggle quite privately. I hide a lot from my wife, I hide a lot from my therapist sometimes. It annoys him. He said, that's what I'm here for, you know, because I it's a harsh word, but infect. I don't infect people with my misery. And if I feel that I'm infecting people, I just put on a mask, which isn't healthy, you know. And yeah, I talk, and I encourage people to talk, and that's what men need to do more, is talk. Women talk.
Yeah,
it is fantastic. I feel we've not conquered it, but we've got to a point where women talk, and they always talk. And I think men need to do that now, start doing that. And I'm on medication. And I say to people, medication's not the answer. But if you put you on that even keel without you dip to depression, fucking take it.
Yeah.
Take it until you're happy. Things suffer, like sex life, like your moods and everything suffers. But if it makes you get up in the morning and function, do it.
Yeah.
And I say to people, take every day as it comes. Do not think a week ahead. Do not think a month ahead, a year ahead. Think of today. Put your feet on the floor and say to yourself, I am committed. I am committed for today. Whatever today throws at me, I'm going to face it head on. All right? And then go to bed and wake up the next day and put your feet on the floor and say, I've committed for today. And that's what you need to do, you know? And that's what I do. I commit myself. I can't, yeah, I've got a school. All right? I'm not contradicting myself. It's that this is what I want to do in the future. Because, yeah, I do, but I take every day as it comes, you know, and that's what I do. And I think of suicide. I think of suicide every day.
Every day.
Every fucking day. I've suffered from suicide ideation, so I think about it. Not necessarily I'm going to carry it out, all right? But I've planned it.
Have you?
Yeah. And I'm very open about it.
Yeah. And when do those thoughts come in? Like, at any time, or could you...
Now, every day. Okay. Every day. I walk around this. I go downstairs to the car park, see people.
Yeah.
And I say to my therapist, I talk to Tanya, and I said, you know, one day I won't be here. One day I will be here. You know, even I've got so much going for me, I can't. And people say to me, it's the past, Craig. You've got to move on from the past and what you've seen. Some people can do that.
Yeah.
Some people can not focus on the past and think of the next day, as in future. And go, right, this is, I'm not going to go backwards, I'm going to go forwards. You cannot control your brain. You cannot control what your brain thinks about, stuff like that, and the horrible shit and the thoughts. Even though you shake it and eat it as much as you like, you're still going to think those thoughts. If you can cope with it, and you can put things behind you, brilliant. But I can't, you know? And that's my problem. I can't. Yeah. I think about it all the time, you know?
I was going to say, because, and again, just like outside looking in, as you've already said, like people are going, you got so much going for it, and you'd be like, wouldn't the world be a poor place without you? Mm-hmm. Telling your story and helping people with your survival school. But like you said, you can't control how your brain reacts to me saying that to you.
No. And I think what also stops me is because I'm a nice guy and somebody's got to find me. And why should I infect somebody else who sees my body? You know, and I said it to Tanya, and I said, you're the selfish one. And she goes, why am I selfish? You're selfish, keeping me here. You're selfish. You know?
Yeah.
And she goes, good. Good. I'm glad I'm fucking selfish.
Yeah.
It's because I'm your purpose.
Yeah. You know. She must be a bloody strong woman, eh?
She is. She's stronger than she thinks. You know? And I've said it loads of times. No one knows what she got through. No one knows. Everyone's wrapped up in themselves to realise what my wife goes through, her family and everything. They don't know what she goes through. They don't ask or ring up and say, how are you? No one does that to her. I do.
Yeah.
I always check in, just checking in.
You can see how important is that for anybody to check? Yeah. To begin.
And she's, yeah, don't get me wrong, we don't have walkie patches. But we face them head on and we strive and march forward.
Yeah.
You know? And I wish somebody could understand what she goes through, and I think get a little bit of pressure off her talking.
Who does she talk to?
No one.
No one?
No one. I don't think there's much out there for the wives.
Right.
You know, and these charities that offer help for veterans, you only get a few sit-ins, like six sit-ins and everything like that, and then you've got to reapply and do it again.
Yeah.
You know, my therapist, I've seen for 4 years. Constantly, you know, I scream and shout him, fucking that, but he doesn't pop watch. He will sit there and look at me.
Yeah.
And we talk, like last night, we talked for 2 hours. You know, I meant to be there for an hour, we just talked,
right.
And I spew all my fucking issues up. You know, all my pressure that I'd built up, the cold spring of life and visions and nightmares that I have. And there's nothing out there for partners. I feel there's nothing out there.
Right, okay. Yeah, yeah.
You know, there probably is. But I feel nothing. A lot for veterans.
Mm.
Not for... And some of these charities do go, yeah, bring your partner along. How about you constructing a partner?
Yeah.
Me being...
Yeah, exactly.
Because if my wife was sitting here now, I wouldn't open up fully.
No.
Because you always raise on and upset them.
Yeah.
But if she was in on her own... She would help her.
It'd be a different story,
you know?
Wouldn't it?
And she's got stories. Oh, she spoke up about... She's done a podcast, you know, and people asked her, but I've always been there with her.
Boys, specifically, young males, a lot of them, I think, you know, confused, challenged in, you know, growing up in the current world that they're growing up in. I can really kind of relate to that with my own teenage years. They might not feel they're, you know, academically qualified, and they might feel that, you know, teachers, school doesn't understand them, so they spend more time out of the classroom than in the classroom. You know, it happens to everybody at different times, doesn't it? Knowing what you're here for, not what your purpose is, but it can take you decades before you work that out. What advice would you have, given, you know, your story, what you've been through, the ups and downs and challenges of your life? What would you advise, you know, young males, lads?
Do not go down the dark hole of that rabbit hole of gangs, knives, drugs, or anything, because it will fuck your career up, future on down the line. You may be enjoying it, you know, or mixing with the wrong people, but they're not going to be there when you're 50 years old, when you're 40, when you're 30 years old. They're not going to be there, you know, because your childhood's gone. And if you're in so much drama, not many people will take you on as a job. You have a criminal record. So you've got to think of that to begin with. And also, join the army, join the forces, join the Air Force, the Navy, the Marines, or do something that's going to put you career-minded. Right? Don't become a sniper. Don't become this. Get a fucking trade. Join the engineers. Right? Get all your licenses. The army. Make the army work for you. Don't work for the army.
I like that.
All right?
Yeah.
Get all your licenses. Get all your trades. Bricklaying, carpentering, surveying. Join the REMI, become a mechanic, get all your qualifications. So when you leave the army after 7 years, 10 years, 22 years, you've got something to fall back on.
And they've paid for all that for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because at one point in your life, you will have children, you will get married, you will have responsibilities. And if you've got something under your belt that's secure, that you can provide with your family, Bob's.
Really good advice. I've been asking that question lately and getting different answers. I think that's spot on, really sound. People have got a platform, want to help share your story. People want to go to survival school. People want to read your book. Best way to get in touch?
Go to my Instagram, COH Craig Harrison. Drop us a message there. We try and answer everyone. Now, I say to people, we answer every message, which we do, but I've been overwhelmed. I've got thousands, and it takes time. So please, please, it takes time, but I will get back to you. Go onto my webpage, the Maverick Survival School. Just type that into Google, and it'll come up. Drop me an email. It goes straight to my Maverick email, and I'll respond to you straight away. Even if you've got dramas, you're suffering, you can't cope with things, I can get Ross to talk to you and stuff like that. And, and buy my book, Longest Kill. I believe it's a good read. The audio book is really good. And the guy who narrates it is fantastic, apparently. I've never met him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I never met him. But I've heard of people saying the audio book's fantastic.
Yeah.
And the guy who does it is amazing. So, yeah, have a look, have a read, you know. And the last thing, yeah, just concentrate on your career. Concentrate on what you want to do, right? For the future.
Tell me, like, being overwhelmed with the messages, has that come off the back of, say, like, James English podcast, Dodge podcast?
And also my book? Instagram.
Your Instagram.
Yeah, I leave a lot of messages on my Instagram, and I talk about mental health.
Yeah.
I talk about techniques that work for me. Like recently, I've just done one, and I've said a weighted blanket. All right? It's a double blanket for a double bed. It weighs 10 kilos. It's heavy.
Yeah.
All right? So if you're suffering from anxiety or stress, get a weighted blanket, sleep underneath it, and it's that pressure of that weighted blanket that puts your body at ease, and you'll sleep so much better. And I've just done one. The amount of messages that I've got saying I've just bought one, it's changed my life, what a fucking game changer, where's it been all my life and everything.
Really?
Yeah,
amazing.
Techniques that I use to help me to function through the day, I tell people. And if it works for you, it works. If it doesn't, we'll try something else.
Yeah.
You know, but give it a go.
Craig, it's been an amazing conversation. I have some really interesting ones this week, like I said, from Chris Phillips-Smith to AFC Bournemouth goalkeeper. This would be my favourite one. So yeah, it's just raw and it's real, and you can, you know, not everything I can relate to, of course I can't, because I haven't been through what you've been through, lived different lives, but I just know that this is going to help so many people, and I know the impact you're going on, like my friend Dodge's podcast, and that's where you came into my view, and I was just like, right, I need to get you on. And I know, again, you do get better people, but I know clearly, busy in a good way.
Yeah.
And if we can get you doing, you know, what you love permanently, then let's do it, man.
Yeah, appreciate that.
Awesome. Thanks a lot.
No, thanks for having me.
Thanks for watching this episode of Screw It, Just Do It. Let me know what you thought of it in the comments below this video. Has this episode helped move you closer to where you want to be? All that I ask is that if you enjoyed this episode and that it's moved you closer to getting to where you want to be, that you share this episode so that it helps one other person do just the same. Just ask yourself what small action will move you forward to get you from where you are, then screw it and just do it. Until next time.